Coming up next from the grassy knoll, a terrifying look into the Orwellian world of brainwashing, disinformation, and ultimately control over
you.
We're going to start another series entitled The Road to Orwell. This is going to be based on a book by Ian Slater, The Road to Airstrip 1. This was published, I believe, in, I'm paging through the book, 1985, published by W.W. Norton and Company. It's a pretty neat book for those, well, even for those who are not necessarily aficionados of Orwell and what he knew. But it is interesting, and I'm going to start with Chapter 9. I'm going to bounce around a little bit. What I'm looking for is just how much Orwell knew about what was to come and perhaps why he knew it. Two other matters before I get into reading the book, and that is one, in the Conspiracy Part 9, I was trying to get a grip on where David Ben-Gurion's quotes came from, along with a whole bunch of people from back in 1962. And I was trying to, you know, rack it around. I thought it was looking, and indeed it is. The Next 25 Years is the title of an article that appeared in Look on January 16th, 1962. It's volume 26, number 2, second issue of that year. And a lot of celebrities, luminaries, whatever, gave their supposed projections about what life might be like in 1987. And although many of them are right on the money, they are a little bit early, and I don't think that they were guessing at all, and neither was Ben-Gurion. Also, I have misstated a book that came up, I guess, when I had Greg on the show from A Cult of Personality. It is The Invisible Government, not The Silent or Secret Government, as I've butchered it, and it's online. Very interesting that it's online, and I think you should avail yourselves of it. It was a pretty heavy-duty book back then in 1964. It isn't that much of an aha to us, but it does provide an accurate record of what was going on, especially as it applies to the Bay of Pigs, that 1962 aborted invasion. And you can see all the chapters there. Just do a Google. It comes up, I guess, on a Spanish site, Bibliotech something or other, and I bookmarked it. If you have any problems, let me know. I'll send you the link. All right, now, Chapter 9 from the book The Road to Airstrip 1, again by Ian Slater. Orwell never liked bullies. They can be the stuff of nightmares. And in, quote, Writing Down from Bangor, that is the title of an article he wrote in 1946, he says that the twin nightmares that best beset nearly every modern man are the nightmare of unemployment and the nightmare of state interference. He fought both, yeah. But before Spain, as we have seen, Orwell had been largely concerned with the problems of unemployment. After Spain, he increasingly turned his pen toward the problems surrounding state interference. In January 1938, at age 34, Orwell had completed Homage to Catalonia, which was published by Secker and Warburg in April. Golance wouldn't touch it. In March, Orwell had fallen ill with tuberculosis, the disease that would plague him thereafter. It would cause his rejection by the Army for service in World War II, and finally, exacerbated by the cold climate of the Inner Hebrides, would kill him in January of 1950, 7 months after the publication of 1984. In 1938, short of money, in parentheses, only 900 copies of Homage to Catalonia had been sold at the time of his death, end of parentheses. And only recently, back from 6 months in a sanatorium in Kent, Orwell accepted a loan from an anonymous donor and, that's interesting, and went for a holiday with his wife in the warm climate of Morocco. There he began writing, Coming Up for Air, in which the visions that he had began to have in Spain of the coming world war with fascism, the consequent food queues, secret police, and the loudspeakers telling you what to think, assailed George Bowling, the ordinary man of Ellesmere Road. Failing to find the old security of Lower Benfield, the home of his youth, Bowling concludes, in parentheses, before Orwell had written Inside the Whale, that there is no way back from the abyss, no retreat into nostalgia, no possibility of putting Jonah back inside the whale. Unlike his old friend Porteous, the retired public schoolmaster who refuses even to think about Hitler, in parentheses, this German person, and thinks that the modern world should be simply be ignored, Bowling sees that he is going to be caught up in the conflict, whether he likes it or not. Orwell points to the growing storm beyond the whale of complacency in a letter of December 28, 1938. Writing of his progress on Coming Up for Air, which he finished before Looking Back on the Spanish War, in which his fears of a nightmare world of state interference are so pervasive, he notes that the novel is, quote, really a mess, but parts of it I like, and it suddenly revealed to me a big subject which I've never really touched before, end of quote. The big subject, totalitarianism, would be dealt with more fully in Animal Farm in 1984, but already for Bowling and Coming Up for Air. And this is from the book. It isn't the war that matters. It's the after-war. The world we're going down into, the kind of hate world, slogan world, the barbed wire, the rubber truncheons, the secret cells where the electric lights burn night and day, and the detectives watching you while you sleep, and the processions and the posters with enormous faces, and the crowds of a million people all cheering for the leader till they deafen themselves into thinking that they really worship him, and all the time, underneath, they hate him so that they want to puke. Back to the book. Envisaging, viewing a world of the streamlined men from Eastern Europe who think in slogans and talk in bullets, Bowling goes to bed in his flat, overcome by the tremendous gloom that sometimes gets hold of you late at night. So powerful is the gloom that, at the moment the destiny of Europe seemed to be more important than the rent and the kids' school bills and the work I'd have to do tomorrow. In January 39, still in Morocco and as depressed as his character, George Bowling, by the prospect of war, Orwell again fell ill and in late March returned to England. Coming Up for Air was published in June, a typical three-month feat which shames the delays of modern publishing. But even with the money he earned from his journalism, Orwell's income was so small that his wife took a job in the censorship department of the Army Medical Corps. By June 1940, Orwell was extremely depressed, not least by his rejection as medically unfit for active service, and he complained bitterly that it was awful to feel so useless when fools and pro-fascists were being assigned important jobs in the war efforts. His willingness to fight despite his dark mood early in the war that George Bowling had foretold signals a turning away, in parentheses confirmed in My Country Left or Right, in the parentheses, from the fatalism of George Bowling and from the anti-war pamphlet that he had wanted published. Above all, it was a rejection of the quietism of those inside the whale, the quietism voiced by Henry Miller when he told Orwell in 1936 that he was an idiot to go and fight in Spain, as was anyone who got mixed up in such ventures from a sense of obligation. It was a return to the belief that you cannot simply accept things, but that, just as Eric Blair had descended into the world of the poor, you have to drag yourself out of the soft belly of the whale when duty or necessity demands it of you. A Hitler or a Stalin gives you only two choices, to sink or to swim. Jumping ahead in Chapter 9 of The Road to Airstrip 1 by Ian Slater. By the summer of 1945, Orwell had begun the first draft of 1984. In August, he became the vice chairman of the Freedom Defense Committee, formed some months earlier because of a growing concern with violation of civil liberties. Sound familiar? In the same month, Animal Farm was published. The book signals not only Orwell's return to the novel form, but his entry into the technique of the fable, with its ability to transcend the boundaries of the present. After the poor sales of Homage to Catalonia, it also marks the end of Orwell's experimentation with the documentary technique. In 1947, Orwell, discussing Gollancz's book, In Darkest Germany, draws attention to the relative failure of the realistic approach in its efforts to make people, quote, conscious of what is happening outside their own small circle, end of quote. He remarks, quote, the now familiar photographs of skeleton-like children make very little impression. As time goes on and the horrors pile up, the mind seems to secrete a sort of self-protecting ignorance which needs a harder and harder shock to pierce it, just as the body will become immunized to a drug and require bigger and bigger doses. Orwell's point is well taken. For instance, 34 years later, in 1981, one was able to read in Hugh Trevor's Roper's review of Walter Lacour's The Terrible Secret that not even members of the Jewish press in Jerusalem at the time of the war were able to believe the extent of the Nazi brutality, even for a people for whom persecution had become a fact of life. The whole scheme of extermination was beyond human imagination. In any event, it was not the present or the past that now made Orwell so pessimistic, but the future, our present, in which such immunization or emotional anesthesia might make us even more insensitive to the plight of others. You have to be thinking about this in terms of today and have your hair stand up a little bit on end. It was this after-war following the Spanish Civil War that had haunted George Bowling in 1938 and that continued to trouble George Orwell in 1944, when, because of the Tehran Conference, he wanted to discuss the implications of dividing the world up into, quote, zones of influence, interesting, end of quote, and the, again, quotes, intellectual implications of totalitarianism, end of quote. The first major attack against the latter in his fiction came in Animal Farm in 1945. In his preface to the Ukrainian edition of the book, Orwell sets down his reasons for the attack, recalling the manhunts in Spain that had occurred simultaneously with the purges in Russia. He notes the shock that he experienced when, after seeing people jailed by communists in Spain merely on suspicion of unorthodoxy, he discovered that in England the communist versions of the purge trials in Moscow were being swallowed whole. The gullibility of so many numerous and sensible people in England alerted Orwell to three things. 1. How easily totalitarian propaganda can control the opinion of enlightened people in democratic countries, where people living in comparative freedom have no real understanding of things like concentration camps, mass deportations, arrests without trial, press censorship, etc. 2. That because of the belief that Russia is a socialist country and that every act of its rulers must be excused if not imitated, the acceptance of totalitarian justifications of such acts had caused great harm to the socialist movement in England. And 3. That in order to revive socialism, the destruction of the Soviet myth, that is, the belief that Russia is a socialist country, was essential. Having thus decided on his return from Spain that he would embark upon an exposé of the Soviet myth, in parentheses, and these are quotes from Orwell, I consider that willingness to criticize Russia and Stalin is the test of intellectual honesty. End of quote, end of parentheses. Orwell had set his mind to thinking of a story that anyone could understand and that would be easy to translate in other languages. A story like the old fables of Aesop, in which animals displayed the characteristics of people, which he and Eileen had discussed in bed together in the happy summer of 1936. But this wouldn't be a nursery tale populated by figures like their poodle Marx. It would be a cry from outside the whale, one voice resistant to the totalitarian tendency and its attendant atrocities, a protest against those in the belly of the whale, merely accepting things as they were. Although it would be 6 years before it was written, the idea for Animal Farm gelled one day in a village where, quote, I saw a little boy, perhaps 10 years old, driving a huge cart horse along a narrow path, whipping it whenever it tried to turn. It struck me that if only such animals became aware of their strength, we should have no power over them, and that men exploit animals in much the same way as the rich exploit the proletariat. End of quote. Orwell had once again seized upon Blair's simplistic division of the world into rich and poor so that everyone could recognize the basic conflict between haves and have-nots. Yet the attack upon the Stalinist mentality behind the Russian myth quickly revealed the sophistication that moved T.S. Eliot, who rejected the book on political grounds, to praise the work as one of the best of its genre since Gulliver. In light of Orwell's increasing concern with the power of orthodoxy to hold even highly individual minds captive, I give here a brief description of the story behind the publication of Animal Farm. After the socialist editor Goelantz, who had wanted nothing to do with Homage to Catalonia, rejected Animal Farm, Orwell sent the manuscript to the firm of Jonathan Cape. An impressed reader gave a favorable report to Jonathan Cape, who then made Orwell the offer of a contract. However, before finishing the proposal, Cape decided to check first with an official at the Ministry of Information. The official warned that the novel would injure Anglo-Soviet relations. It was then, in June 1944, that Orwell sent the manuscript to T.S. Eliot at Faber & Faber, advising him that the novel was undoubtedly politically unfashionable and explaining how someone, either from Cape or the Ministry of Information, had, quote, made the imbecile suggestion that some other animal than pigs might be made to represent the Bolsheviks, end of quotes. Orwell adds his words, I could not, of course, make any change of that description. End of the quote. After Eliot, who was highly conscious of the political situation at the present time, this Anglo-Soviet alliance, rejected the novel, Orwell took it to Frederick Warburg. Not finding Warburg in his office, Orwell, in haste, reached him in a local pub. Warburg recalls the scene. And it's a dialogue. And the I in this is Warburg. What is it? I asked. Read it yourself, he said nervously, though I don't suppose you'll like it. It's about a lot of animals on a farm who rebel against the farmer, and it's very anti-Russian, much too anti-Russian for you, I'm afraid. What's it called? I said. Animal Farm. I think you can find some bucksheet paper to print it on. A few moments later, he was gone. Back to the book. Warburg read in the same day, quote, never doubted that it was a masterpiece, end of quote, and promptly told Orwell about that. Still, Warburg's decision to publish was not easy. The great debate that took place in his office mirrored the power of political orthodoxy, often born of the needs of alliance, to subjugate individual integrity. It was a theme devastatingly described in the very novel under discussion. Warburg writes, was it or was it not politically dangerous to publish this bitter satirical attack of our great ally, the Soviet Union, when its armies were rolling back the German forces, while the UK and the USA had established a mere bridgehead on the French coast only a few weeks before? Senhaus had no doubts. I rather think he felt Stalin might have enjoyed the portrait of himself as the Boer dictator. After all, Orwell had christened him with a mighty name, Napoleon. Our young sales manager, Peter Maxwell, supported him. My experienced London traveler, Charles Roth, was extremely worried. He was a lifelong socialist and could not really bring himself to believe that Russia was not a socialist state, however flawed. Worst of all, I was under strong pressure from my wife, whether it was the blood of her Circassian grandmother or her belief that Russia had always been a kind of feudal tyranny, or the warmth of her feelings for the immense sufferings of the Russian people, or, perhaps strongest of all, her knowledge that it was the Russians who had done most of the fighting since 1941, Pamela at that time regarded Animal Farm with a complete lack of sympathy. Her quote, if you publish that book, I'll leave you. Don't think I won't. One thought plagued Warburg, namely, that if the Soviet Union was yet to come to terms with Hitler, both dictatorships might turn on the West. He was as aware as Orwell that just because censorship can be executed in a civilized manner, it is no less invidious. Quote, just a nod and a wink and the thing is done, end of quote. And he could envisage the possible repercussions of publication, the burst of outrage from the Russian ambassador, followed by, and here we go into, and I'll take a look at where this is at, and I'll read the footnote. But there's a, this is ripped from somewhere. It might be Warburg's reminiscences. Followed by two smooth gentlemen from the Foreign Office. My dear Warburg, breaching the alliance, situation extremely grave. Minister feels sure. Withdrawal essential. Perhaps 2 or 3 years' time. As a patriotic man, you surely understand. Then when it was all over, on a lighter note, off the record, of course, Red's not our sort of people. Stalin, awkward customer. Read a little book myself. Haven't laughed so much since. All those pigs around the table. Wonderful scene. Reminded me of, well, never mind. again with Warburg. And then as they prepare to leave, again a quote from these two smooth gentlemen, "Funny thing, damn red like Orwell, fought in Spain, didn't he? Couldn't think it all up. Hmm, well, well, what will these literary gents get up to next?" And back to the narrative. What Orwell got up to next, at least in his fiction, was 1984, begun in mid-1945 before Animal Farm was published. Here the lesson of Animal Farm, which, as Crick points out, far transcends an attack upon the Soviet regime, would be more closely examined. Notes for 1984 had been in existence for some time. In 1944, Orwell was already convinced that there will only be room in the world for two or three great powers. Interesting. Reiterating his Spanish-born nightmare, he wrote later that year, quote, "If the sort of world that I am afraid of arrives, two or three great superstates which are unable to conquer one another, two and two could become five, if the Führer wished it." End of quote. But while he argued that this, quote, "so far as I can see, is the direction in which we are actually moving," end of quote, he qualified the dire prediction by adding, quote, "though of course the process is reversible," end of quote. I'm going to end on something I think is, well, I'm not going to end, this is going to end a certain section of chapter 9. We're going to go on, but we'll go back to this statement, and you'll know in just a reason why, in just a minute, why I believe that is the case. All right, it says, the qualification takes us back to Orwell's imaginary conversation with Jonathan Swift, in which he argues, unlike Swift, that men can be changed, that totalitarianism can possibly be averted if men are brave enough to fight it. This is important because it reminds us that 1984 is meant to be a warning, not a prophecy. So let's go back and take a look at that. Jonathan Swift, he wrote a radio play in which he sits down and talks with Jonathan Swift. And Swift says, there's no change in mankind. You know, and so this is really at the core of 1984 and what a lot of us have been wondering about, whether it is prophecy or whether it's warning. But let's take another look at it. One, do you think Jonathan Swift is wrong for believing that man will not change? I mean, I agree. Humankind will always do what humankind does, tend to corruption, and that's one of the reasons why we said on the show many times throughout at least this year that if we could have reached a society, a civilization that was devoid of corruption in high places, we would have had it, or we'd still have it. But time and time again, it's not the case. I mean, history tells you one thing and one thing alone. Human government really doesn't work in the end. All right, so that's my take. Jonathan Swift figures man will not change. Orwell saying, yes, man will change. And so let's read this again. The qualification takes us back to Orwell's imaginary conversation with Jonathan Swift, in which he argues, unlike Swift, that men can be changed, that totalitarianism can possibly be averted if men are brave enough to fight it. This is important because it reminds us that 1984 is meant to be a warning, not a prophecy. But the thing is, if Orwell is wrong, as I believe he is, then 1984 is indeed a prophecy and not just a warning. I feel it's both, and not just a warning, and not just a prophecy. So I think Orwell being wrong about the nature of humankind then necessarily means that 1984 is a prophecy. As well as starting 1984 in mid-1945, Orwell continued with his journalism and essay writing. The result was that in 1946, despite a rest period, there appeared a rush of essays, along with various journalistic pieces, from, and these are titles, The Prevention of Literature, in the magazine Polemic in January 1946. Another article, Politics in the English Language, in the periodical Horizon, in April 1946. And also to Politics versus Literature, in the September-October 1946 issue of Polemic. Such titles, including Writers and Leviathan, reflected Orwell's growing concern with totalitarianism, that if the latter could stamp out the, quote, autonomous individual, then the writer was, quote, sitting on a melting iceberg, an anachronism, a hangover from the bourgeois age, as surely doomed as the hippopotamus, end of quote. The culmination of this concern would occur in 1984, in which the conscious passivity of the writer and everyone else is assured through force and the destruction of language as we now know it.
Just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean they're not out to get you. Visigoth's Grassy Knoll continues.
In this last and somewhat abbreviated section, for part one of The Road to Orwell, Slater writes, in Orwell's completed vision, the totalitarian tendencies of the modern state are born in the drive for power, not the desire for power to improve society, in parentheses, as in the original motivation in Animal Farm, in the parentheses, but power for power's sake. This tendency, he believes, is nurtured by the increasing centralization of authority and industry that ironically is, quote, a necessary precondition of socialism, end of quote. The result of such a drive for power in the ruling authorities of 1984, accelerated by increasing centralization, is revealed when we read what Goldstein, the enemy of Big Brother State, has to say in his treatise, The Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism. We read that throughout history, despite changing names, there have been only three kinds of people. The high, the middle, and low. Goldstein, redrawing class divisions that had earlier set the battle lines of Orwell's English period, notes, quote, the aims of the three groups are entirely irreconcilable. The aim of the high is to remain where they are. The aim of the middle is to change places with the high. The aim of the low, when they have an aim, usually they are too crushed by drudgery to think about anything beyond their daily existence, is to abolish all distinctions and create a society in which all men shall be equal. Although material progress has been made, argues Goldstein, no social or political change has changed this essential division. Although Goldstein's view of history incorporates Orwell's earlier simplistic views of societal division, it also goes beyond them. What is new in Goldstein's theory, which is Orwell's essential theory of the totalitarian state, is that while once only the, quote, high, with a few middle-class parasites, had clung to the idea of a hierarchically structured society, softening it for working-class people like the Pithers in A Clergyman's Daughter, with sentimental promises of rewards in the afterlife. Now, quote, the new middle groups proclaim tyranny beforehand, end of quote. Whereas they had earlier cried for equality in their quest for power, they became as tyrannical as the displaced high. Once they acquired power, and now make no other pretense other than to cling to old names for equality, or variations of them such as INGSOC, which in parentheses for social, for English socialism, in the parentheses. Apart from this pretense, they unapologetically attack any notion of human brotherhood. It had once been acceptable, and more importantly safe, for the power-hungry members of this middle group to clamor for equality, because technology had not reached the stage whereby inequality could be done away with. Once technology has made equality theoretically possible, when, despite necessary specialized functions, there is no need for the division of labor that had traditionally been the excuse for class distinction, equality ceases to be a slogan for those in power. Equality that might be realized becomes a threat to them, and is even assailed by people, like those middle-class socialists of The Road to Wigan Pier, who are not in power, but hope to be. Thus, we read in Goldstein's theory that because of technological advance, by the 1940s, quote, all the main currents of political thought were authoritarian. Every new political theory, by whatever name it called itself, led back to hierarchy and regimentation, end of quote. You know, and this makes me, again, try to figure out where Orwell was at because of these statements. And no, they may not be his thoughts necessarily, but his characters. But, again, yeah, it leads back to the same hierarchy and regimentation. Moving on. Nevertheless, although the modern hunger for power seems to lead back to the old tyrannies, Goldstein wrote, there is a glaring difference between the old tyrannies and the new. Whereas the old tyrannies were at least partially seeded by some liberal ideas, Big Brother's regime is devoid of them. The party whose distant origins are in the salaried middle class and the upper grades of the working class is devoted to absolute opposition of liberal ideas because such ideas endanger the party's pursuit of pure power. In the time of Winston Smith, such opposition to liberal ideas presents no problem, but this was not always so. in the early days, immediately after the revolution, which, parentheses, as an animal farm in Stalin's Russia, end of parentheses, had merely given way to a new tyranny. The party, before consolidating its power, had moved to justify its control, understanding that it was widely assumed that socialism must follow the expropriation of capitalists as day follows night. Those in power realized that the most effective way of remaining in power was to present the regime as essentially collectivist, in keeping with the old socialist principles. Therefore, no party member is allowed any private property beyond, quote, petty personal belongings, end of quote. In fact, ownership of the means of production is in fewer hands than ever before, parentheses, hence oligarchical collectivism, end of parentheses, creating the illusion that a group of owners is not as exploitive as individual capitalists, even though the group consists of owners nevertheless. For example, the house in which the interrogator of the novel, O'Brien, lives may be owned by the state, the collective, but it is still a mansion compared to the dismal rooms inhabited by members outside the inner party. Unlike the socialists whom Orwell criticized in The Road to Wigan Pier for losing potential converts by concentrating solely on economic factors, the party does take account of the non-material aspects of life. It does this through Big Brother, who, while not existing as a real person, forms the guise in which the party chooses to exhibit itself to the world. Big Brother drains off potential dissatisfaction with the state by acting as a focusing point for love, fear, and reverence, emotions which are more easily felt toward an individual than toward an organization. Into the hole that Orwell believed was left by decline in religious belief, the party image put the image of Big Brother, replacing the concept of God with that of another apparently all-knowing and all-powerful being. Big Brother state is divided up into the inner party, or brain of the state, the outer party, or hands of the state, and the dumb mass of proles, who constitute about 85% of the population. What is new, compared with old tyrannies, is that from its start, the party has been adoptive, not hereditary in nature. That is, it proclaims that merit, not family, is the basis of promotion. Together with the secret thought police, that helps it to maintain power. The origins of party membership may lie in the old salaried and professional middle classes, but admission into the inner and outer branches of the party is through an examination at age 16. The party does not do this or prohibit racial discrimination, because it is in any sense liberal or fair-minded. The secret thought police hardly had its origins in liberal thought, but because it sees that the strength of a regime, and thus its longevity, resides in continuity of policy, and this comes not in the continuity of a bloodline, but in the continuity of a particular worldview. Orwell, having advocated the change from privilege to competence in reforming the leadership of England, understood well the attraction of such recruitment among a populace still conscious of unequal opportunity in a world of class privilege. As Orwell also sees, however, it is the apparent fairness of the party's, or any party's, merit recruitment system, which is based on competence rather than privilege, that obscures the fact that the end of class privilege need not mean the end of inequality. Let me say that again. The end of class privilege need not mean the end of inequality. To replace privilege by merit is only to replace the criterion of class division, not to do away with such division. There is a shift here, then, from the earlier Orwell, who tends to confuse meritocracy with equality, to a position in which we see that power may just as easily be the salary of meritocracy as the inheritance of privilege. We're going to bring it to an end right there. This is from Chapter 9 of the book The Road to Airstrip 1 by Ian Slater, written in 1985. In time to come, not only will you see shows posted on Mondays, and those links will not be hot until Monday, even though it may be pre-posted through the weekend or whatever. That's mainly just to facilitate things between myself and the webmaster. And there might be other shows that pop up during the week as well. So, I mean, we've got the website. Might as well use it. Go and hit it as frequently as you feel you need to see if anything else has popped up, and surely there will be. This is also giving me a chance to have a little bit more flexibility in what I do. And I don't think this will be a problem. I hope you still are okay with all this. As I said once before, it was nice to have the live involvement and that we all could get together at 11 a.m. But we still can get together at 11 a.m. It's just that it won't be live. And also, because of the lack of exchange that we've had, and you folks have been really good about it, in emailing and IMing, also when you hear this, if you have questions, if you have comments, just send them to me. We'll read them on the air. We'll still have the exchange more or less. What I'm interested in knowing, if any of you feel like you want to kick back it, to me an answer, and that is, was Orwell being prophetic, or was he warning that this could happen? Or was he being prophetic in the sense that he knew it would happen? If you feel like you'd like to chime in on that, I wouldn't waste your energy. Obviously, I'll read those responses on air. I think they're important. And certainly, you know, I have no inside track in all this. I just believe that he knew exactly what was coming down. All right, that'll wrap it up for now. We thank you for listening. Please stay with us as we go through these series. And also, we'll have more guests. Barry Chamish coming up next week, Eugene Narette, and hopefully a whole host of other folks that you may not have heard before. All right, so thanks a lot again for sticking with us. And this has been The Grassy Knoll, and we will see you down the road.
Please fasten your seatbelts.